welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, man.
Before I watched the film, I read a lot of stuff about how it's probably the most intimate look into Kurt Cobain's life yet. And having now watched it, I would say that's absolutely, you know, absolutely true. Is that something that was intentional from the outset for yourself making the film?
Well, we wanted it to be honest, and we wanted it to be unflinching. And I think the level of intimacy really wasn't something that when I started, that was like the goal. The goal was to allow Kurt to tell the story of his life through his art.
Yeah.
That was sort of the sort of main idea going into it. But what I realized very quickly was once I had collected all the material I would have to make the film, that when I contrasted the period between 91 and 94 when Kurt was in the public's eye and viewed the footage that the public had seen, and when I contrasted that with all of the private material we had assembled, I realized that the film would have to, in order to really get to Kurt, would need to rely heavily on this personal material. And that most of that was the reason it feels so intimate was that it was either recorded by Kurt himself or by one of his friends or his wife. So it ended up becoming as intimate as it is, sort of emerged that way.
And am I right in thinking you were literally sent boxes and boxes of this stuff from Courtney herself?
Well, I wasn't sent boxes. I was given access to a storage facility
that
contains, all of Kurt's possessions and art. What happened was after Kurt died, in those first few days, Courtney started giving out Kurt's, gave away a bunch of his stuff to mourners out on the street. And I think one of their friends felt that before this gets out of hand, they needed to take everything and throw them in boxes.
Right.
And so they collected all of Kurt's stuff and threw them in these boxes. And eventually those boxes made their way to California. And I was given access to them to document them.
So where do you start when you get into that storage facility and you see, because I'm assuming there were a lot of these boxes.
Well, it was only 27 when he died. I mean, there was more than I would have left at 27.
Yeah.
But he was still 27. And you got to understand that at the point I had access to the vault, I had been talking about doing this film for years. So in my mind, it was going to be Raiders of the Lost Ark or Citizen Kane in this huge storage facility with like row after row of material. And in fact, they're going to this sort of large empty space and there's 20 boxes in the middle of this room that felt very small in that space. However, you open up a box, it's not, you open up box 18 and there were 107 audio cassettes that hadn't been transferred or most of which had never been heard. So even though it was a small box, it yielded big results. I'm very pleased to say and happy to say that there was no interference from anyone.
You had full creative control
from Universal Pictures and from the estate. But there was a tremendous amount of support, and most of that came from Francis.
Yeah.
Once Francis came on board as our executive producer, everybody wanted to participate. I could not have made this film without Francis' support. If I had gone out and tried to make this film with Courtney, we would have had doors shut on us left and right.
Yeah.
When you talk about authorized projects, they usually mean that they're watered down because the family is trying to protect something.
Right.
Right? So what made this unique was Francis has no memory of her father.
No, of course.
Right? He died when she was, before she was two. Neither Francis nor I had that history with Kurt that would have maybe shaped some of our decisions. We were able to approach it, I think, more objectively.
Yeah.
And so the support I had from the family was in granting interviews and providing materials. But I believe they would have made a completely different film than I would have.
Of course.
I know Kurt's mother and sister and Christ would have all made totally different films as Courtney would have. And when I finished the film and I screened it for Frances, she in essence said something like, that's the film that we need to put out there.
Yeah.
So I think in that sense, it was successful.
That's great. And I suppose it gives Francis, as well as yourself and everyone watching, a glimpse into a life that they might not have known.
Well, I think the feeling with the film is kind of akin to like meeting an old friend for the first time.
Right.
That we all sort of, we know Kurt or we have our own histories with Kurt, but you're going to get so much more than you would expect By the way, I mean, I think most people, including myself, thought there was nothing left to see, hear, or show. And like I said, 85% of this film is never before seen or rarely seen material, and that was out of necessity.
It gives it a new bit of background to people like myself as well. You know, I've been a Nirvana fan for many years, but I was young when this all happened, you know, to Kurt, and I've looked at all of the things that are available, but there's never been anything as kind of, I don't know, comprehensive as this to me, that really tells a story. And it's actually a story of his life as well, isn't it, rather than his death. Obviously, it has all the events towards the end leading up to it, but it's going through absolutely everything. I really felt like I knew Kurt a lot better. Like you say,
you know the film Boy, you know the film Boyhood.
Yeah,
yeah. When I saw that last summer, I was struck by the similarities between Boyhood and Montage of Heck. Stylistically, very different films, but you get the sense with Montage of Heck that you're sort of in the passenger seat going through life with Kurt. You know, and it's a rare position to be in. But I think the fact that his mother had documented his first 10 years so successfully, both on Super 8 film and then with saving all of his art, and then Kurt picking up that storyline from when he was a teenager and just creating endless amounts of material, we were able to put together an image and view of Kurt that that otherwise would never have been seen.
Yeah, and I think the combination of, like you said, that family footage, as well as Kurt's own stuff, made it, I couldn't believe how intimate it was. It's like, you almost feel like, I would never normally get to see this from anyone's family unless I was really part of that, you know? It was really opened up.
Well, that's the thing I've said about the film, which is, like, if this was made about a guy named Bob Smith, I think it would still be a fascinating endeavor, and I would be as interested in making and viewing this film. It just happens that it's Kurt Cobain, who we have a public fascination with.
I wanted to ask you though about the animation in particular. So was this created from a lot of it from Kurt's own drawings and then brought to life? How did that process happen?
Yeah, there's two forms of animation in the film. One is where we take his art and his journals and we bring them to life. And that was done by an artist named Stefan Nadelman. And we spent about a year developing the aesthetic because, Kurt's world needed to be analog. Mm. I'm best known for a movie called The Kid Stays in the Picture, which ushered in this sort of 3D digital photo animation technique that's readily used now. And that style would never work for this movie. So we needed a style that was appropriate for a film on Kurt. And I wanted it to feel analog. So with the journals and his artwork, we photographed all of them, but then found the style that made it look like we were shooting them sort of on Super 8 handheld. And then the other animated components, the ones where you physically see Kurt, were done by a Dutch artist named Hisco Huisling. And like all of us who worked on this film, I think we all kind of felt the weight of the subject matter and all sort of wanted to, deliver our best work. So Hisco created 6,000 individual drawings, 58 oil canvases for his 7 minutes of sequencing. I mean, it's like Disney level style animation.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And what do you think when you're watching the film back is the most powerful moment?
I really like the sequences in Tracy's apartment. They're the animated sequences. There's a 7-minute section of the film where you never see a photograph or film footage of Kurt.
Yeah.
It's all depicted through journals and animation. And in those 7 minutes, I feel that we get closer to Kurt than we can ever get. And it's just because of the audio. It's funny. We think of film and photography, but Kurt was so expressive with how he used audio and both music and sound collage that I found it far more expressive. I mean, part of the reason the film is called Montage of Heck is I found when I discovered the mixtape Kurt had made, Montage of Heck, I felt that it was like a portal into his psyche.
Yeah.
And that it was probably the single greatest expression of Kurt, even though he didn't compose it. I felt like in those moments listening to that, I was right there with him. So that sequence I'm referring to where you hear Kurt answering the phone and writing all this great music. Yeah. And you can see the smile. You feel the smile on his face, and you feel his sense of contentment not being bothered by anyone and just being alone. And it puts a smile on my face to be able to see Kurt, or to experience Kurt in such a pleasurable way.
And it's also, that's the point in Kurt's life as well, where it says in the film about him kind of having a home for his own almost for the first time. That's sort of what he was trying to achieve with Tracy. And this is him then in that comfortable place on his own, creating, isn't it?
Yeah, I you know, there were these moments. There were those moments, and then there was stuff right after Nirvana broke and he went on retreat with Courtney.
Yeah.
And he seemed so happy and so, like, just like, if it could have gone on like that, it would have been, you know, But, and then the Vanity Fair article happens, and I remember thinking, just as a viewer myself, when I watched the film for the first time, at that moment, going like, no!
Yeah.
Like, leave him alone.
He felt like an attack, didn't he?
Just let him be, man. He's happy. But they brought that on themselves. You know, there was nothing to promote when they did the Vanity Fair article.
No.
Courtney, you know, couldn't resist doing it's the press.
Do you think it was vanity?
Of course it was. Yeah. She, Lynn Hirschberg was celebrated, celebrity journalist wants to come do an article on you for Vanity Fair. Mm. If, you know, Kurt, I don't think would have ever really agreed to do it. But Courtney at that point, you know, was, you know, she's very upfront about how ambitious she was.
Yeah. And I think because of I would say that because of the happiness that he was feeling around that time, that's where a lot of the trust in perhaps decisions like that was coming from. You know, he felt comfortable in this environment and with Courtney. So he went along with it, I guess. Do you think?
Listen, if I were repping them, I was their publicist, I would have, at the state of mind that they were in at that point, there's no way I would have let them near a microphone.
Absolutely not. And obviously we heard from Chris in the film, and one of the things he said that struck me was, you know, he's looking back at it in hindsight with 2020 vision and thinks the signs were there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they were there.
Yeah. And why is it, do you think, no one saw them? I mean, there was obviously speculation.
Because, you know, listen, if Kurt was a pop artist, like, in One Direction.
Yeah.
And suddenly he starts producing some of the art that he did, I think people would flinch.
Mm.
You know, but Kurt was part of the underground. And stuff that he was doing, like at the beginning of the film where you see him at Reading and he it shows up in the medical ward gown and he collapses, right?
Yeah.
Like, that just felt punk rock and funny.
Mm.
But now when we see it through a different lens. Right?
Exactly.
And so I don't think it was anyone's fault for missing the signs, even though they were clearly there. A lot of musicians have written about, been more direct about suicidal thoughts or stuff like that. I think that it's one of those things when someone dies that you start to, it's easy to look back and go, yeah, it was all there. And it was, I mean, now looking at it and watching the film, yeah, it was there from the time he was two.
Yeah.
I mean, Kurt used to say that he had a happy childhood till he was, till his parents divorced, but I didn't see that. I saw the cracks at two and a half, around the time his sister was born. And it's not just what I was saying is mom and dad in the film talk about how before Kim was born, they needed to address his hyperactivity.
Yeah.
That was 2 years old.
Yeah, that's hard for parents to deal with as well when you've got a child that young.
Well, it's hard when you're an 18-year-old parent or a 19-year-old parent and you haven't, quote-unquote, sowed your wild oats. And yeah, I think it was a difficult situation for everyone.
I find that stuff fascinating about looking at Kurt's art and his lyrics and the style of the things that he was creating and not being able to tell because you think, oh, he's part of the underground. And I think there was a clip of an interview in there where someone was asking him about I Hate Myself and Want to Die and not being able to work out whether that was, you know, punk rock satire or was this a deeply troubled individual, and Kurt's response was just sort of laughing it off and not giving anything away at all, wasn't it? So
it was haunting. I mean, that was an interview with David Frick, who's never allowed any of his audio to ever be publicly disseminated. Frick's, you know, the music editor for Rolling Stone, has been forever.
Yeah.
So this is the first time he's allowed one of his tapes out, and I'm so indebted to him because that interview to me stood out amongst all interviews with Kurt for several reasons. Kurt had a tremendous respect for David, you know, that he just because he grew up reading him.
Yeah.
You know, so Kurt was a fan of sorts, and David knows how to use that and doesn't. Most interviews when they would get to Kurt were sycophants.
Yeah.
You know, they would try to like invite him over for tea. And oh man, when you're in London, you got to, you know, and Frick was talking to him more like a therapist. So he would say to him, so song, I Hate Myself and Want to Die, wow, that's really disturbing. Kurt would be like, well, it's a joke. And where a lot of people would leave it alone, Frick would pursue it and go, well, I don't get it. What's the joke?
Yeah. Is it actually? And it's interesting because you see in the film how Kurt reacts to almost the rest of the press. You know,
yeah, no, he reacts totally different. Yeah. I told David recently, I was like, I felt like you were my voice in the film. Like you were pressing on and things. I mean, in fact, a lot of the Frick interview that you're hearing in the film, you're not even hearing Kurt, you're hearing Frick.
Yeah.
Like when he talks about, you got to be careful about what happens if you get everything you look for. You know, what you know, this whole Midas thing that leads into the teen spirit sequence. Yeah, I found David's interview to just be, it was the, I think one of the last interviews should be the last interview Kurt did in the States. And yeah, it's pretty remarkable. Also, there's something in that interview that I found in hindsight to be more than telling, which was, and I never heard Kurt mention this anywhere else, where he talks about how he doesn't have anything left to write. And one thing about suicide, you know, which I've read a little bit about since I started working on this film, is that's a common thing that for an artist when they've just put out their sort of work and you're at that abyss, and you got to remember Kurt had never been at a point where he didn't have anything.
No,
he'd been collecting songs since he started writing songs. I mean, most of Nevermind was written during the Bleach period, and so here he arrived at the first time in his life, and he didn't. He was out of material, and it's a small thing, but I think it's considerable.
I think for someone that creatively switched on, definitely. Yeah. And in some of the earlier interviews in the film as well, when people are asking them about, you know, how successful do you want to be as a band, they're all responding with, well, we just want to never stop writing music, and we want to write the best music we can write, and that's all they're interested in at that point.
See, the public didn't even know this because the public perception was that he was going to record with Michael Stipe, right? Mm. That was bullshit,
right?
That was never going to happen.
Yeah,
I don't know if this has ever been publicly put out there, but that was.
So where did that start?
I think it was they wanted to give Kurt something
to help him over that abyss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to look forward to.
Wow. So yeah, I guess it's tricky, the idea of having nothing to look forward to as any kind of person.
I don't know, but I just want to be clear. I don't want to overemphasize it because I think it's one piece
of
many pieces. I think that the bigger catalyst for what happened is revealed in the film.
Yeah.
It has little to do with not wanting to play music anymore.
Yeah, and that's this whole everything going on with Courtney.
Yeah, with Courtney and his family. Yeah.
Now, what's coming up next for you, if you know, and if not, who would you most like to make a film about next?
You know, I would pretty much. When I'm making a film, I'm all in. I don't think of anything else. I don't develop other films when I'm making a film.
Yep.
I'm just a slave to the project. And this has been, you know, the last couple of years of my life. So it's hard for me to say. I would be lying to you if I didn't say that, you know, I've been harboring fantasies for years of doing a Led Zeppelin film.
Okay.
But, you know.
Well, if any man could do it, I think it would be you. Thank you so much, Brett, for joining us. Check out Montage of Heck in cinemas this Friday.
All right. Thanks, man.
No worries.